I'm Peggy Clark, and welcome to The Bridge. The Bridge features wise women and a few good men of different generations in revelatory conversation about what matters most. The Bridge is a podcast of the Aspen Institute, a nonpartisan forum for values-based leadership and the exchange of ideas. Today, I'm here in New York City, and I'm excited to have the opportunity to speak to a pair of really inspiring women. I'm joined in person by Erin Carmon, senior correspondent at New York Magazine and a CNN contributor, among many other things. Erin's also the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which spent at least 3 months on the New York Times bestseller list. Erin is also a frequent moderator at the Aspen Institute and a dear friend who we have celebrated in so many ways. And joining us on the phone is a wonderful journalist named Linda Hirschman, and she's in Arizona, where the flowers are in bloom as we speak at this moment. Linda is a lawyer, a cultural historian, and the author of Sisters-in-Law, How Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg Went to the Supreme Court and Changed the World. Linda is also coming out with a really powerful book that will be hitting the bookshelves in June of this year, which is called Reckoning, The Epic Battle Against Sexual Abuse and Harassment. So welcome, Erin.
Thank you.
And welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
Great. We're so glad to have you two with us, two heroines of mine. So let's just jump in. And as both of you know, the focus of the Bridge podcast is really to create a space for women from different generations to be in conversation with one another. So it's a little funny, though, sometimes to define what generation you're from. So let's just start with that. Linda, how would you define what generation you're from and what defines your generation?
I'm a baby boomer. I was born in 1944. So, and I would say that what defined my generation was the civil rights battles of the 50s and then ramped up in the 60s and 70s.
Wonderful. And Erin, what about you? How would you describe your generation?
I think I'm an old millennial. I was born in 1983. And I think that means for me that I remember life before the internet, but only a little bit. And my generation, I think, was very shaped, the older millennials, by 9/11, which happened when we started college, in my case, and in some ways made people risk averse and I think lessened interest in domestic concerns or non-national security concerns, including feminism and civil rights. And then I think I've also been shaped by subsequently the internet providing an opportunity for movements to be reborn and for feminist-informed journalism to happen.
Great. That's excellent. So that really, when you think about that, the span of civil rights movement to where we are today with internet-based movements is really, really interesting. So I love having this conversation with you both today because you've experienced so much. So both of you share this deep experience with Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and both of you written books about her, and they're fantastic books for those of you who are listening that haven't read them. So let's start, Erin. What compelled you to write about Justice Ginsburg, and what drew you to her as a figure?
Well, I mean, Justice Ginsburg is someone that I've always been fascinated by as somebody who, as a child, was always in the library, was always looking for biographies of women and never found enough of them. I actually think I went through all of them and then read them again. Somewhere around Mary Todd Lincoln and Julia Ward Howe, I exhausted the supply. And here was this woman sitting on the Supreme Court using her voice in dissent. You know, Notorious RBG was started by my co-author, Shauna Knizhnik, when she was inspired by Justice Ginsburg's dissent in a voting rights case in 2013 in Shelby County versus Holder. And so when we teamed up, what we wanted to do was to get the kind of anarchic spirit of the meme, to have a little bit of fun and a visual identity, but also be really true to who Justice Ginsburg is, which is that she is someone of fierce integrity and values. And those values include gender equality. And the ways in which she construes gender equality, I think, remain enormously relevant for our time.
Right. Excellent. Wonderful. And Linda, tell me, what about you? What drew you to write about her?
So I actually encountered Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she was a law professor, because there were these meetings of the handful of women who were teaching women in the law courses in the early 70s. And she was there with her manuscript for her casebook. So I met her before she was RBG. And then I watched as she set to work at the ACLU to accomplish through the 14th Amendment what the Movement for an Equal Rights Amendment had failed to do. So I graduated from law school in 1969 and encountered the entirely male-dominated and really very hostile world of law practice. But just a couple years after I started dealing with it, Ruth Bader Ginsburg achieved the victory in Reed v. Reed, which was the first time that the 14th Amendment had been applied to discrimination based on sex. So she was a hero of mine in my life.
Wow, that's so incredible. So both of you have come to know RBG on a kind of a personal level. And Erin, I understand that she actually officiated at your wedding. Is that correct?
That is true.
So tell me a little bit about your sense of her as a leader and what you found most interesting in studying her as an individual.
Well, you know, since we are having this intergenerational conversation, I think it's so fitting, because the story of Justice Ginsburg, I think, is an inherently intergenerational one. You know, when she was in her first part of her career as a civil procedure professor, she was not engaged in feminism. She actually came to that in her 30s, when the young women who were baby boomers of Linda's generation, who had worked in the civil rights movement, came to her and asked for a course on women in the law. And she began volunteering at the ACLU. And so she actually looked back at her own experiences of discrimination and read them and understood them to be systemic. So she had believed that being discriminated against for being pregnant, for being a woman, for, you know, all sorts of gender-related valences, she believed at one time that that was just the way things were. But it was, in fact, through the teachings of her students that she began to be radicalized and began to do this really impactful feminist work. And then the flip side is, when she then embarks on that journey of trying to figure out, you know, this audacious task of undoing a century or more of precedent that said that it was perfectly legitimate to discriminate on the basis of sex, she's relying on work of women who came before her. And these two women in particular, who, you know, Linda mentioned Reed v. Reed, Dorothy Kenyon, who was a socialist feminist, and Polly Murray, who was a Black woman who probably today would identify as queer, talked about wanting to be a man and had relationships with women, romantic relationships with women, but had been denied a lot of opportunities, not just on the basis of her gender, but also on the basis of her race. These two women had been trying to get courts to recognize equal protection under the law applying to women. And they had not succeeded at the Supreme Court yet. And so when Justice Ginsburg put together her arguments for the Supreme Court, she actually specifically named Polly Murray and Dorothy Kenyon as co-authors, even though they didn't work on the brief. And I think about this story so much, because I think leadership is also the ability to learn, and that it's never, you know, there was this, you know, famous expression, life makes a feminist. Life made her a feminist relatively late in her life. And also, I think an element of her leadership that I think about a lot and try to emulate is the act of giving credit to people on whose shoulders you stand. And it's why we dedicated our book to the women on whose shoulders we stand, because I think she said that specifically. She said they were doing what we were trying to do, but the world wasn't ready to listen. And that acknowledgement, I think, is something that is inherently feminist and really important to enact.
That's so beautifully said. Is there any reflection you wanted to share, Linda, about your thoughts of Ruth Bader Ginsburg as a leader and as a woman?
So I was more, as it turns out, what is more interesting to me about Ruth Bader Ginsburg were the ACLU years. There's a wonderful document in the archives about, I think it was Pauline Murray, who was trying to get the ACLU in the late 60s to pay attention to the issue of women's rights. And she said, I'm just going to tear my hair out, because she couldn't even get the liberal men who ran the ACLU to pay attention to women's issues. So a sea change happened, and we're seeing it again now, by the way, in the in first starting with your next constituency over, that is to say the liberal white men who ran the ACLU, and there was a change in leadership at the ACLU, and R.E.A. Nair came in, and he said he felt that the women's movement was the racial civil rights movement of the 70s, and so that gave them an opening, and he hired Ruth Bader Ginsburg to run the Women's Rights Project. So I was very interested in writing my book about Ruth and Sandra to focus on the 8-9 years she was at the ACLU, methodically amassing the precedents that would ultimately lead to the most equality you can get without passing the Equal Rights Amendment. The other thing that interested me very much was her relationship with Sandra Day O'Connor, who was the first woman on the Supreme Court of the United States. Indeed, the story I start the book with, which was of Sandra Day O'Connor, was assigned the very desirable task of writing the opinion of the Supreme Court in the case that integrated the Virginia Military Institute. And she wouldn't take it. She said, this should be Ruth's. So I felt like those two women had a relationship, and as Erin just expressed, Ruth had a relationship back to Pauline Murray and Dorothy Kenyon, and when Ginsburg came along to the Supreme Court, she and O'Connor had a relationship, and those kinds of relationships are really the building blocks of a social movement. So I was very interested in exploring their relationship.
Go ahead, Erin. You want to jump in?
I just wanted to say, you know, Linda used the word methodical. So when you ask about what Justice Ginsburg's style was and continues to be, I think that this is always the paradox of it, is that she is a supremely deliberate, cautious by nature person, but who sought radical ends. She sought to overturn these decades and decades of precedent. She imagined a world that would be far more equal. That is an inherently radical thing to ask. But the method in which she did it was step by step, cautious, making it seem like this was just the natural progression of things. And I think that's what's funny, is that a lot of the pop culture images of her are of a firebomb, and that's true in some way. But there's also this element of her that is very traditionally ladylike and works through institutions, but pushes them to live up to their promise.
Right. That's so interesting. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, the public response to Notorious RBG was massive and huge, and is really still going on. It gives so much joy and pleasure to so many people. But were you surprised by that reaction? And what about RBG and your book do you think resounded with the public?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm proud of the book that we wrote, but I think the response has really been to Justice Ginsburg. I think the documentary that came out this past year on the basis of sex, the feature film, I think it shows that there is an inexhaustible desire to hear stories about this woman's life. And I think it's because everything that she was doing is a live issue, right? If you think about the kinds of cases that she brought before the Supreme Court, they involved women's work being counted equally, women's public contributions being counted equally, but also whether men should be recognized under the law as caregivers. She was bringing cases, this one didn't make it to the Supreme Court, but about the government coercing women to have abortions. So this broader question of reproductive freedom was something that, you know, it wasn't her focus at the ACLU, but it was something that she had been engaged in and believed passionately in. And so I think that people are discovering the stories of her life. And they're honestly, you could fill a bookshelf now And I think it's because of her. And I think it's also because, amazingly, even though she has been in public life for decades, people still feel like they're discovering her.
Yeah.
So. And I think that speaks to the fact that she's been underestimated her entire life, and the fact that she became a celebrity at age 80, which is when Shauna nicknamed her the notorious RBG. There was a countercultural element of it, because I think in particular, older women are not recognized for their achievements and are told that it's somebody else's turn. And the fact that at this very moment that she might have been considered to be irrelevant or old or whatever, everybody suddenly wanted, as she said, take a picture with her, was tattooing her face on their bodies. I think that it was also to celebrate her is also to implicitly reject the assertion that older women aren't cool.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I'm happy to hear. Linda and I are happy to hear that. So, Linda, let's move to something a little bit different about you two, who are so brave and have been so pioneering in so many ways. So, Linda, first of all, you're coming at this work as a lawyer, and so that's influenced the way you think about social justice. But you've been working on the fight for women's rights for so long and for so much of your life, and you've had such a discerning eye that you're bringing to it. So let's talk about where we are at this moment right now, 2019, and what setbacks concern you the most right now? And also, on the other hand, what are you encouraged by in terms of progress in this country on women's rights right now?
So in some sense, what Erin just said feeds right into my pros and cons. And that is, when I was working on the joint biography of O'Connor and Ginsburg, Shauna put up her page about Ginsburg, the notorious RBG, after the Shelby County case. And I immediately started following it, because how social movements develop is my turf. And I knew immediately, and this has turned out to be so much more true and powerful than I even realized, that there was a new young generation of women coming up. That's why I call that chapter that Erin is in, Feminism Revived. So these youngsters, Shauna was a law student, and Erin, who is a fully grown person but is still, younger than my daughter, were recognizing the value of the radical second wave of feminism, which Ruth Bader Ginsburg represented. So espousing Ginsburg was their way of reviving feminism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that is, to my mind, the most encouraging thing that has happened in a long, dry spell.
And what's concerning you right now, Linda? What are the things that you're, what are the setbacks or the things that are happening right now that you're most worried about?
I am worried about the elections, because as a lawyer, all of the social movements I write about have a strong element of law in them. As Tocqueville said, in America, sooner or later, every social issue gets to the courts. And the thing that concerns me the most is that forces that are hostile to women's interests are now in control of the White House and the Senate, and therefore the life-tenured federal courts, including, of course, the Supreme Court. That's what worries me the most. I mean, I was catatonic on the afternoon of the midterms of 2018, so I am now starting to feel the mounting terror that goes with the upcoming election.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about voice. Both of you, at a certain point in your life, decided you needed to talk about women's rights and women's issues in a public way. And what was the moment, Erin, when you realized you could take that brave step and do some of the hard reporting you've done? And when did you first become of the need or the urgency to be public about these issues? And then, Linda, I also want your thoughts on that as well. And how have you been brave enough to do that?
Well, I love when Linda talks about how social movements happen through relationships, because for me, I mentioned looking for biographies of women and always just being more interested in women's stories because they were the ones that we didn't hear. But I was first focused on being a journalist, and I remember going to the March for Women's Lives while I was in college, 2003 or 4, and being told by a very nice male journalist mentor that was fine to do when I was in college, but I would have to stop doing it if I wanted to be a journalist. Now, I now think I have two minds of it because I now would rather be covering the rally than holding a sign at it or speaking at it. But I also am a person with a stake in this world. I also have a point of view, and that point of view includes the radical notion that women are people. And so I think I have always thought seriously about how to reconcile being a journalist with being a feminist and a person in the world with ethics. And I would say that it's actually the space that was opened up by women like Anna Holmes and Rebecca Traister, who I know, you know, are also part of the conversation that Linda is writing about in her next book, because Anna Holmes founded Jezebel and hired me for it when I was about 10 years ago. And Rebecca Traister was writing brilliantly at the intersection of politics, pop culture, and gender, and showed that there was an interest in it and showed that there was a way to do it as both a journalist and a feminist. And I think that the fact that they and others opened up that space made me realize that I didn't have to really choose between those, because in fact they were linked, and that adding journalistic rigor to feminism is how I do feminism. Being a reporter who, the fairness comes in the process, but the choice of story, the ways in which one proceeds ethically, I think that comes from my commitment to equality and to justice.
That's beautifully said. Linda, share with us your thoughts when you first decided to come out and have a voice around women's issues, and what were some of the responses you got when you first started working on these issues, and maybe even some of your thoughts for Erin at this moment in terms of what she just said.
So there were really two moments. I realized when I was teaching law school, I had John Ely, who wrote a book inveighing against the Supreme Court decision that established women's reproductive rights, Roe v. Wade. John Ely, an otherwise liberal white guy, came to my law school and visited. And he shared with us that he thought that the Constitution of the United States extended properly to every right that had been established since Brown v. Board in 1954, up to the moment when people turned to women's interests. And I was radicalized in that moment. I listened to him and I thought, this is wrong. I sort of felt like Ruth Bader Ginsburg was sitting on my shoulder, because she has a jurisprudence that encompasses every succeeding wave of social change. So she says, look, the Constitution is, and the American story is a story of ever-expanding inclusiveness. First propertied white men, then white men without property, then black men, then women, and then with the civil rights voting movement, black men and women. So it's, and now we're talking about immigrants. And so it's an ever-expanding circle of inclusiveness. So why would John Ely say, okay, for race, but not for girls? And that radicalized me. And I wrote a piece about abortion rights, which got a very, very good response. It was very encouraging. And I thought, okay, I can do this. I'm going to make these radical arguments, answering the titan of constitutional law, the Harvard professor, John Ely. I'm going to answer him back. And things went along pretty smoothly until 2003, when I decided I would write about how American women were walking away from the feminist movement. And the book is called Get to Work. And in Get to Work, I make the argument that heterosexual women, and I guess actually lesbians too, but it was a little early at that point, should not quit their jobs and stay home with their babies. And this generated, I would say, a shitstorm of criticism and fury. And the mommy bloggers and so forth. And there actually was a website entitled Everybody Hates Linda.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. Remember, it was 2003, and this was the depth of the backlash before Traister and Anna Holmes and Rin Carmone and Pamela Merritt came on stream. So it was in the depths of the backlash, and I got it full blast. But I knew I was right. I mean, it's, you know, Erin was talking about the discipline of journalism.
Yeah.
I actually have a PhD in philosophy, and I very much rely on the discipline of philosophical analysis in my writing. So I made the arguments for why a life in the public world was more valuable than a life, a subordinate life in the private world of the heterosexual bourgeois marriage. And when I was on 60 Minutes, I was making my argument, and Leslie Stahl looked at me and said, "But that's so judgmental." And she waited for me to melt like the witch in The Wizard of Oz. Judgmental, I'm melting. And I just thought, I'm a philosopher. I looked at her, I said, of course it's judgmental. I'm a philosopher. That's what we do. And so that has always really stiffened my spine and made me clear about what I was doing.
And may I just say, you know, I recently found out that in terms of Linda speaking in a moral voice and in a prescient one, you know, I was listening to, it was Slow Burn, right, Linda?
Yeah.
And it was an episode, so this is a, it was a retrospective about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky and all of the surrounding issues. And it was an episode about how feminists had responded to it. And, you know, there was a lot of complexity there, but it boiled down to the fact that it really seemed like many feminists had not stood up for this young woman who found herself in the middle of this firestorm, in part because of the actions of much older, much more powerful men. Yes, her actions as well, but she was this young intern. And suddenly I hear Linda's voice, a strong moral voice, even at the time, saying, I think, the arguments that in retrospect were the correct ones about how this was an abuse of power and how Monica Lewinsky was sort of left to hang out to dry. And, you know, that was not the popular argument at the time, but I think that it stood the test of time.
Thank you so much, Erin, for saying that. I have to share, I got a DM from Erin after she stumbled across my episode on Slow Burn, and I intend to put it on my tombstone. Erin's direct message was that she was so happy to hear my voice of fierce integrity, and I've been telling everyone that I'm going to have that as my epitaph.
Wow.
You're listening to The Bridge, a podcast from the Aspen Institute. I'm Peggy Clark. If you liked today's show, check out season one of The Bridge, which features revelatory conversations between women from different generations, including Kimberly Crenshaw, Sasonke Misimang, and Milan Verveer. You can find the episodes by searching The Bridge from the Aspen Institute on iTunes. So you both have walked out on that tippy-tottery edge where very few people have tread and have been willing to stand up and say things against huge systems and others. And Erin, in much of your reporting about Charlie Rose, Linda, just the example you just gave about Monica Lewinsky and others, I want to ask you both a really personal question. Where do you get the courage and the bravery? What have you been able to draw upon to be able to come out against very forceful opponents by using your voice? What has inspired you to get through these times? Erin, let's start with you.
So I think, as a journalist, I ask people to be brave all the time. I ask people to tell me about really difficult, painful things that might hurt people that they care about. And I think that that is really brave, right? That's really, really hard to do. And in the end, maybe if all goes well, I get a byline and I get to move on with my life, and maybe somebody gives me an award or something and they're left with the pieces. So I think thinking about how, you know, ultimately, yes, I am very emotionally invested in this, but I am coming at it as a position of this is my work. I'm compensated from it. I'm a upper middle class white woman in this world. So what am I going to do with the opportunities and the gifts that I've been given, with the access that I've been given, the economic security that I've been given? And this is what I think is the best use of, you know, RBG always says she wants to heal the tears in the world with whatever talents she might have. This has been my choice. And I think when it has been difficult, and it has been at times, I really think that being part of a community means a lot. So it means a lot to have friends like Linda and like Anna Holmes and Rebecca Traister and many others who share these values and who know what it's like to be out there on that edge of the cliff. And we'll have your back. I mean, I wrote a story about sexism at The Daily Show a long time ago at Jezebel, a million years ago, but it was the first piece I wrote that was really controversial. And they pushed back really hard. And I got, you know, hundreds of emails of hate mail, really crazy, violent stuff. And I had never really been in the middle of that. And I think the piece holds up pretty well, by the way, because Jon Stewart himself later on just last year said, you know, I was so angry when that piece came out. But I've since really realized that she was right. And the only way that I got through that controversy of just feeling personally under attack for professional work that I had done was through other feminists who had my back. And I think, you know, actually, in my personal experience, journalistic institutions have come and gone, and they've been a mix of good and bad. But the friends that I have who are in this field, and also the friends that I have who are not in this field, which it's always good. You know, my husband is not in this field. And so I think it's always good to have people in your life who have no idea what the controversy on Twitter is. And that keeps it real.
That's great.
But then people who really understand the controversy on Twitter, having your back or doing a gut check with them, like, is this the right thing to do? And knowing that they'll, when, you know, when the hailstorm comes down, that they're going to be there holding the umbrella. I think that that is the only way that I've gotten through the more controversial spots.
That's great. When the hailstorm comes, they'll hold the umbrella. Linda, where does your bravery come from?
Piece of it is that I cannot stop my brain from figuring stuff out. I've always been like this. And, you know, when somebody says something that is manifestly irrational or that cannot be carried to its logical conclusion, my brain just goes off like a fire alarm. And I've never been able to silence that voice.
Yeah.
And so when I saw the white male liberals stopping the civil rights movement at race, which really did not affect them, rather than extending Ruth Bader Ginsburg's scheme to women. And you, after all, you can't move to the suburbs and get away from your wife, so it was going to affect them. I just, you know, I could not be quiet about it.
I'm sorry, that was so vivid.
That was really great.
That's just like the process. I just cannot stop. But I will say it was terrifying to be out there with the Everybody Hates Linda. Like Irene, I had a husband who was not in the field. He was a doctor. And my children and siblings and stuff, you know, were very supportive. So it wasn't like I had this going on all the time. But it was very horrible. And here's the beautiful piece of it. And I interviewed Catherine McKinnon for Reckoning. And so I was just talking to her about it. And she and I said the same thing. How happy we are to have lived to this day when we feel that the young generation, Irene's generation, and even the younger ones like Moira Donegan, and are picking up the rational, logical thinking that we were thinking, to be validated now after so many years of being criticized and kicked around, is so gratifying.
Mm-hmm. That's so wonderful. That's so beautifully said. So this is an important question, but one that all the listeners will be thinking about. You both wrote extensive books about powerful women in the U.S. Supreme Court. So what was it like for each of you to watch the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings play out this past fall and see it center around sexual assault?
So I had turned my manuscript in when Christine Blasey Ford appeared on the scene. And blessedly, my wonderful editor, Deanne Ermey at HMH, said, "Hold the presses. We don't want to be out of date when we hit the shelf." So I actually went back to the book and wrote two more chapters after that happened. So there were sort of two things about it. One was the event itself, and the other was the implications that it had for the midterm elections. I was not surprised that someone turned up with an abuse story at the time. That did not surprise me, because thanks to the reporting of people like Arin and Ronan Farrow and Jane Mayer and so forth and Joe DeCantor, we know they're everywhere. And we know that these very powerful men often leave a trail of abuse behind them. So it did not surprise me that someone appeared with that story. And the other thing that you learn is that it's almost never only one. Am I right, Erin? It's almost never only one.
Yeah.
So as soon as the one showed up, I knew there would be others. The Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation television performance and the performance of the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee followed the exact script that was laid down for Clarence Thomas in 1991. It was to do a full-blown aria of white male or male anger in front of a frightened audience. And it worked perfectly then, 1991, and it worked perfectly last fall. The difference is that in the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, it lined up along partisan lines. So the Republicans who had embraced a confessed abuser as their candidate for president were lined up in the position of defending someone accused of abuse again. Unlike the Clarence Thomas hearings, the Democrats had realigned against the candidates of sexual abuse. So this is what I call the great realignment in my book. And there's a bunch of social science data, electoral data on that now. So at least people who cared about women's rights had someplace to go. The bad news is it was the minority party in the Senate. And after the great realignment, there was no chance that the Republicans were going to abandon Brett Kavanaugh. That's their wheelhouse now. What worried me is that right after he was confirmed, after that performance, after that operatic performance, particularly by Lindsey Graham, and he was confirmed, what worried me was that the white male liberal pundits started writing right away that this was going to cost the Democrats the midterms, that the nation was going to be so angry at women for asking for protection against an abuser that they were going to flock to the party of the abusers and the Democrats were going to lose the midterms. And I have a bunch of those articles in my book. So that's what worried me. Imagine how happy I was when the returns started rolling in.
You know, Linda, I'm going to share this with you, but a pollster has shared with me data that I am about to report on about people's reactions to Kavanaugh and to Blasey Ford and some questions that, and this was polling that was conducted by Tressa Undum in December 2017. So a lot of the polling was, I'm sorry, December 2018.
Right.
And she also separately conducted polling in December 2017 after the first Me Too related reporting stories came out. And she had conducted polling in December 2016, November 2016, about people's feelings about the Access Hollywood tape in which the president brags about assault. And so looking over time at people's attitudes about this and how, in fact, you know, if you go back and you look, you talk about what has changed. You go back and you look at the fact that more people thought that Clarence Thomas should be confirmed immediately after Anita Hill testified. But that was not the case. Because we had just undergone, you know, what Linda terms a reckoning the year before. So you had the problem of things aligning along partisan lines, which was, we had a weird break from that during Me Too, where everybody realized, like, with the exception of the president, it was a bipartisan phenomenon. But Kavanaugh brought it back into the realm of power and politics. And I think that that was the hard limit that we hit upon, is that you could be as brave, you could be the bravest person in the world. You could have so many other people speaking up, but it would come against this immovable force. You know, Linda, you talked about how the courts are where it's at. That was the limit of Me Too. It would not supersede this power struggle that Republicans, the stranglehold that they wanted on the courts and on the Supreme Court above all. And so I think it's really interesting because, this data shows that, in fact, even white Republican women tended to believe her. And yes, Democrats were not able to take the Senate. But I think, you know, there was a real connection between people watching those hearings and thinking about the position of women in the world and thinking about credibility and how we assign who is credible. I mean, I experienced that. It's a, you know, when the world starts talking about the issues that you've been thinking about a lot, it can be almost overwhelming. You know, there was an emotional component to me the moment that she opened her mouth and started talking. We had talked so much about her, and then to suddenly hear her voice for the first time, we'd seen these photographs of her, but we had not heard her voice. And then she had this girlish voice, and she was so accommodating and so helpful and trying so hard to say what she did know and what she didn't know, and being a scientist. It was, I think, one of the most heartbreaking experiences that I've had anything related to public life, to know that she never wanted to do this but felt a duty to do it. And to know that it changed a lot, but it didn't change everything.
It's not going to change everything. The lines are drawn. I would say that they were drawn brightly after the Access Hollywood tape, when the Republican Party stuck with their candidate. And then you have Roy Moore running for the Senate in Alabama. And at that very moment, Kirsten Gillibrand, who's running on a platform of Brave, led the senators in taking on one of her own, Rankin. And I call that the moment of the great realignment. So at that point, you've got the Democrats saying, this is not something we will tolerate, and the Republicans saying, we're going to back Roy Moore. So when the Brett Kavanaugh came along, it was clear to me, in that weird way my mind speaks to me, that this was going to be a hard partisan gender line. But I know the data that you have turned up must be very reassuring, because I got some of it from Brian Schaffner, as you know, recently as well. And I would not fret over the Senate. It was a very stacked deck. And the real plebiscite in America, the closest thing we have in the constitutional system, is the House of Representatives, and those districts went heavily Democratic. White women voted Democratic.
That's so interesting. So you really see this as a sea change, and you see it as the courts, as the place that some ways limited all of the momentum that Me Too really just, you know, it sparked in so many places. So a question that I have for you both is, How do each of you see the massive public outcry around Me Too as affecting the way that we talk about women's issues today? And I seem to hear you both saying that some dam has been broken and we can't go back, and that we have gone forward in part because of that. What are your thoughts, Erin?
I think we've learned some lessons, but that there's a conversation that has to continue. So I think people have become aware that even pillars of the community, even people that we admire, not just the mythical man who jumps out of the bush, can commit abuse and assault and harassment. I think we've gotten some sense of how endemic it is, how it exists in every sector. I think that there's been also slightly more of a tendency to understand the complexity of why people don't report, why they might wait to report, the difficulty in establishing evidence. But I think we have yet to really have the conversation fully about the systemic problems and the ways in which the deck is stacked against victims. And you could argue, I mean, even testifying in front of the Senate is a systemic problem. You know, Dahlia Lithwick did a great piece when Christine Blasey Ford first came out, in which she said that the system is not set up to respond to this. And that's in part because even, for example, the Senate map is part of the systemic reason why Christine Blasey Ford did not get justice. And that goes back to the founding. And so I'm really interested in trying to figure out how do we, as journalists, as historians, as cultural critics, think about systems moving forward that don't perpetuate these harms. For example, the use of money to silence people, the ways in which we assign credibility as journalists, and how do we assess that, and how do we make sure that we're not doing so in a way that re-inscribes biases about who we can believe because they are powerful or successful, and who's on the margins, or who's just disgruntled. And I think it is still the case, and you can see this just by the fact that people are still really angry and blame Kirsten Gillibrand for what happened with Al Franken, that there is still a desire to protect our guy. And that's even the most critical thinkers and even the most feminist-identified people. And I've experienced that as a reporter, and I've experienced it in with people that I care about. Nobody wants to think about how we all are covering up for our guy or looking the other way because we've decided that, what that person contributes is more important than reckoning with who he might be harming.
Wow.
Right. I have broken up more dinner parties by explaining what I'm writing about, and it's always about Al Franken.
Wow. That's
it's
so
astonishing.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah. But just this morning, I woke up and I turned on my Twitter feed, which is probably a really self-destructive thing to do. And I noticed just this very morning that the girls, and I call them that because they're young, at the Bethesda Chevy Chase High School mm-hmm. International Baccalaureate Program or something like mm-hmm. that, found out that the guys in their class, that they were ranking them according to how good-looking or hot they were. And when the girls, male ally who leaked, and when they found out, they organized immediately to resist it. And when the school gave the one who organized it a slap on the wrist, 40 of them massed in the principal's office. This is the change in the attitude that really Gretchen Carlson started in some ways when she sued Roger Ailes. This is the change in the environment. It's so pervasive that these privileged, mostly white, very rich young women at this high school were indignant and not afraid to protest, and protested and were effective.
Yeah. Incredible. Beautifully said, Linda. Thank you for sharing that with us. So we're coming to the end of our time with both of you, and it's such an incredible honor. I could talk with you and listen to you all day, and I think all of our listeners would say, keep it up. You're really a beacon for us all. But we end each episode of The Bridge with asking each of you to share one hope you have for each other's generation. And so, Linda, let's start with you. What's one hope you have for Erin's generation?
So, Erin, Corinne's generation has totally fulfilled my hope for them. I can't even say what you would want to say is I wish that Erin could turn her attention to writing about the opera or something, because the social, real harm that she chronicles would be behind us. But I actually have always believed that it's the, I think it was Machiavelli who said that it's the highest of all callings to preside over the founding of a new order. And having been a second wave feminist in the 70s, we had the wonderful opportunity to play that role. And now I see Erin and Rebecca and Anne and all the rest in their generation playing that role. And I couldn't wish for anything better for them.
Thank you, Linda. Wow. I mean, yeah, it's funny that circumstances have kept feminist writers very much in a sort of full employment. If you wish for us to be put out of business, I hear you on that. I wish for more people to be like Linda of her generation in terms of her profound curiosity and interest in understanding of the ways the different generations express feminism, because it still happens that when I speak to groups, and it tends to be an older crowd, that people will come up to me even now and say, why aren't young women calling themselves feminists? And I mean, those women in Bethesda, those young women in Bethesda who are 20 years younger than me, they're showing the way, right? And the Parkland kids are showing the way. And the Moira Donegan, who I think is about 10 years younger than me, the campus activists, by the way, when I was in college, people were very complacent about feminism. And I'm now seeing, I went to Harvard, and in Rebecca Traister's book about anger, I talk about the fact that I really took for granted the deeply gendered hierarchies that existed there, including in these private clubs. And it was the women who followed at me who were really standing up and saying, we're not putting up with this. So I wish for that activism and that work to be recognized and affirmed the way that Linda is already doing.
Beautiful. So I'm so honored to have had you both here today. Thank you so, so much. You're both really wonderful, wonderful models for us all. So thank you.
Thank you for creating the space.
All right. Thank you for inviting me.
And really thank all of you for listening to The Bridge, a production of the Aspen Institute. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'm Peggy Clark, and thanks for listening.